Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, the podcast channel on the New Book Networks. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Sami Hermes and Serene Sawalha about their new book, My Brother, My Land, A Story from Palestine. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Maybe we can start first about that you tell us a bit about yourself. Where you are right now, and how did you end up where you are basically right now? Maybe we can start with Serene.
Yes. Hello, everyone. So I live now in New Jersey in the United States. I left Palestine after high school to study college in Jordan. And in 1990, I moved to New York, worked in the United Nations for a few years, and then start a family and moved to New Jersey. And as of now, I'm a high school teacher in New Jersey, in the United States.
Thank you so much, Serene. And what about you, Sami?
I'm in Doha, Qatar. I'm an associate professor at Northwestern University. I teach anthropology. I have a PhD in anthropology from Princeton University. I've been here for a number of years. And I work on Lebanon and Palestine.
Thank you so much for you both. And how did you both meet, and when did the idea of the book emerge as a project?
Go ahead.
You want to go ahead? So I started at Princeton University as a graduate student in 2004. I was in my first semester, I was supposed to do a mini ethnographic project for one of my anthropology classes. And I decided that I had been an activist on Palestine, and I just got into Princeton, and so I thought this would be a good way of meeting the Arab American, Palestinian American community, is to go and do a little mini ethnography on the community and find people there. And through that, I met Serene. And I remember well when we first met, maybe the first or second meeting, just listening to her tell her story, and and sort of not just the way she told it, but also the story itself was really captivating and important. And I felt, it was a story that we heard often in the news. We hear about often, but it's not something that we really dig into or try to sort of understand. And so I asked her if she wanted to, tell the story, and, if she wanted to maybe write about it someday. Didn't expect it would come out in 2024 at the time, but it is what it is, I guess. I don't know, Serene, if I missed anything or you want to add?
No. I mean, as a resident of the area, when I moved from New York City, I wanted to continue with activism. And I myself did not know anybody in Princeton. So I remember my neighbor told me there is a protest in campus. And I really went there and I tried to meet the community. And I met Rima, which is, she's the one who introduced me to Sammy. And then when Sammy came into my house, we sat in the living room. I was so excited. I could not wait for somebody to tell me, let's do something like that. So we ended up meeting. Everyone is there. And I just record. And as soon as Sammy leave, I will be cleaning, I'll be cooking, I'll be taking care of my three children. And at the same time, I will be remembering and recalling more events. And right away, I'm recording them so I don't miss them. The following one is there when Sammy comes. So I really look forward for that. And yeah, Sammy talked about the 24. Sammy graduated, got another job somewhere else, and then started family, got married and had children. So wrote another book, and I was there always reminding Sammy what's happening with our book, what's happening with this. And then finally, we took it seriously and we start proposing it. Sammy proposed it to a couple of printing press and a couple of places offering us. And then here we are, you know. I'm glad finally it came. I feel it's in the right time. And like Sammy said, there's so many stories. We could write 15 million Palestinian story. Our story, it's unique because it's small village, small family, and how the occupation impacted me and my brother, my sisters, my mom and my dad, and our uprising.
Thank you so much, Serene. And what exactly made you wanted to tell Sami the story of your family? What why did you wanted to tell him your story specifically?
Telling the truth, since I moved to the United States in 1990, every time people ask me where I'm from, I felt in the U.S. people don't know even where is Palestine in the map. And every time I speak the name, they refer it to somewhere else. For me, every time I met with anybody, they're American or Middle Eastern, I always recall details from my childhood, from me living under the occupation, first intifada, second intifada, visiting my brother in prison. So I always tell anybody who are in front of me. I never stop sharing. And when I found anybody who could approach me and says, you have an interesting story, let's record it or let's write it, I jumped to the idea. So when Sammy showed interest, I did not say no. Anybody would show interest, I was willing to share my family experience with them. And it became Sammy who offered me to record, and I did not mind it at all. I did not hesitate, actually, because I always wanted people to understand and read and know how every Palestinian in Palestine and in Gaza Strip are impacted with the occupation in daily life. So that struggle is something always in my mind, and I always wanted to share with everyone.
Thank you so much, Serene. And coming to you, Sami, maybe, with the book structure, you structured it into two narratives somehow. And how hard was it for you to capture Serene's voice and include it into your book as an academic work?
I have to say it was quite difficult, and I think I spent a lot of time trying to sculpt it in a way to do that. I really wanted Serene's voice to come out on the page, in the sense that, as I said, the way she tells a story is very captivating. And so I transcribed a lot of her, the recordings, and tried to, in a way, convert it from the genre of oral storytelling to the written kind of a story, and to make sure that her story was reading well, just, from the recordings. And then trying to sort of somewhat influenced by the genre of oral history, where you have the, in this case, the researcher and then the subject, but the subject speaks in those. So I wanted to try to capture that. But at the same time, we both wanted a story that people will read, read and be moved to act from reading. And so I think that was the more difficult part, because it could have just been like, you know, maybe just an introduction to like what she's going to say and then say it. But I wanted it to read like a conversation, read in a way that was continuing itself. Like the, so it's, you know, there's a narrative plot and narrative structure and so on. And that was very difficult to kind of sculpt in this way.
And did you use any other material resources for your academic part besides Serene's voice? Like, what kind of archival material did you use, maybe to contextualize this your story as well?
Yeah, I mean, I spent some time in the Center for Palestine Studies in Beirut and the archives there, but also looking at newspaper articles, a lot of newspaper articles, especially to kind of capture and understand the time periods and the different time periods, because we're talking about from 1966, 1967 till the early 2000s. And so just making sure events were properly captured, also just lifestyles. The village changed, life in Palestine changed, to try to, you know, sort of capture that. So I had to dig into that. Also, I used the archives also to get some of the materials from Islamic Jihad, to better understand political party and that resistance movement. There was the need to kind of dig in further there.
Thank you so much, Salami. And for you, Serene, it is quite a really, of course, personal story that you are telling to Salami. What stories did you include, and were there any stories that you thought about not including or giving them to Salami?
You know, it's funny that it's the other way around. I wanted to include everything, and Salami is the one who did not want to. For me, Salami actually said he did research, but the most important for me for the book that Salami came and visit to Kfar Rae twice and spend days and week with me and my family in daily life. So me and Salami, we walked in the streets, we walked to school, we walked to the land, and he got the chance to speak to every member of my family and to some of the neighbors and people who are from the mayor to the principal of the school and some other community member. That was very important for me, for him to get the feeling of the landscape of the village. But in the same time, I wanted the reader to know everything, the good and the bad and the ugly, all the stories. And there is so many stories. Salami will say, no, we're not here to expose your family. But the idea to say, for me, I want to know why everybody took that path or did that decision based on the condition they were in, living in. But in the same time, there is people who could be impacted by those stories politically. If I mentioned some details about some of my family member, it could be very hard for them to visit, or it could be they could be harassed or arrested by the Israeli occupation based on those story and those details. So we tried to, one of the story, we removed it actually a few weeks before the printing based on this. So for me, I really wanted to share everything. And then Salami was hesitant in a couple of areas.
And how does it feel? Sorry, Salami, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I wanted to say it's really difficult when you're trying to tell a real-life story, and you know all this, you know, you have all this material and you know all these stories. And all those stories make up her life, and all those stories make up her family's life. And if you tell one less story, then you feel like you haven't told the whole story, right? And it's very difficult to get out of that zone as myself and as Serene, I think, because we're so invested. I mean, for her, it's her story. It's like you didn't do something complete. And for me, I started to, you know, become so close to them. And so once we got in touch with Stanford, and, you know, now we have a publisher and editors were coming in at Stanford and otherwise, they would say, well, you know, this is distracting from the telling of the story. This is slowing down your story. This is unnecessary. But then for us, it's like, no, but, you know, all that becomes the life, you know? And so that's, I think, the difficulty.
Yes. And you mentioned it, working with the publisher, what kind of were you, both of your roles in working on the book, like Serene, did you worked on the chapters as well together with Sami, or was it mostly that Sami worked on it and you looked on the text and then gave the okay, or how did the roles work between you two working on it?
I mean, every time Sami shared with me the copy back from Stanford, for a couple of times, actually, I have hard copy. I will print it out and read page by page and look at their comment. And then later on, they send it a few times. And literally, every time they shared it, even the last time before it really went to Brent, he shared it with me. And I read the book from page one to the end and look at all their comment. And me and Sami back and forth messages that, no, I like to keep the story. It's fine if they cut this. It's fine if it's edited. There's a couple of story like I really insisted they should stay, and Sami has to communicate with them like we would like them to stay. And there's a couple of story I did not mind if they asked to be removed. But yeah, I really kept in with every time the editing. A version came back, I will read it and look at it over and over and over again. And me and Sami communicate on a daily basis. I always make a joke that if we empty the WhatsApp between both of us, I think we can have another book just in WhatsApp messages. And you could see the conversation between both of us about each comment or about each story and each copy coming back and forth from Stanford.
Thank you, Sami?
Once I... had more of the sort of initial draft kind of complete, that I would, as Serena is saying, I would, you know, send it to her, and then we would kind of go back and forth on the little details, right? So, you know, if even like the color of a dress, or, you know, what do you, did I get, like, you know, when she's crossing the bridge, is, you know, do you do this or that? And so there was sort of a lot of that kind of back and forth, sometimes in, like, as she was saying, edits on the draft, and sometimes in, like, WhatsApp messages. There was one, I just remembered now with a marriage, when Iyad gets married, and trying to explain to the English reader the idea of Katb al-Kitab, and, you know, what happens, and, like, is that a marriage, is it a wedding, is it a, and just going back and forth, because trying to understand the sequence of events, just because it's, you know, even at the, you know, when I first heard the story, it wasn't that long after things had happened, but still, you know, you don't have all the information, and Serene also doesn't have all the information, and so just trying to get that information, and asking her sisters and asking her mother, and so on. So even when we had the draft, we would, I remember sometimes saying, maybe you should ask your sister. And so she would talk to her sister and then get back to me. And like, you know, in the text, in the margins, write down, you know, some answers or what, to sort of get it accurate.
And do you have both like one most striking moment during working the book that you were thought was memorable for you both while you worked on it?
Striking moment. I'm thinking, Sammy, do you have any? Did I come up with something?
I mean, I think for me, the moments were, I mean, there are a few, but I think the research itself, in the sense that meeting different family members, I think for me, meeting one of her brothers for the first time and sitting and talking to him in Jordan, it was I think with Ihab, I think it was very very touching for me, because he hadn't seen his father and his brother in a long time, and he was talking to me about it. And I remember it was a sort of very striking, and of course being in Palestine, I think the first time I went to Palestine, and that this was actually, you know, real, that I would be able to be there, was very you know, life-changing, of course.
Yeah, and when Sami visit to Kfar Ra'i, you need to remember it's a small village. Everybody know everybody. And then this man is coming from the U.S. with this woman, which is me, and then walking in the streets. And I'm introducing him to everybody as he's going to write a book about this small village. So I remember that so many people will invite us, and I never been to their homes. They're inviting us in, and they want to share so many of their story. I remember one person share with you his poetry and some of the things he wrote himself about the village, describing the village and the life in the village. So it was really nice how people were welcoming, opening their home and their doors to these two stranger people. For them, I'm a stranger because I've been living overseas for 34 years now. And the way they wanted to share and welcome him, it was really touching. And then him staying with us in my mom's house, she wake up in the morning and want to make all his favorite food, and she wants him to try this and that, was very nice. And like Sammy said, even going to Jenin, to the main city, and try to find people who spent time with Iyad, and try to record them. And some people were fearing from recording, and here I am, I'm pushing people to speak freely, convincing them to be recorded, because I want the rest of the world to hear the truth from their mouth, from their experience.
You know, there's one other thing I want to say is I was very stuck with the writing, in trying to stay true to everything Sirin said, but at some point it was holding me back. And I remember the moment very clearly. I was talking to some people, and I remember the moment very clearly when just realizing that I should not second guess. There's a way that being colonized, being oppressed, you always second guess yourself, that you know, they tell you your life is not true, and you start to believe that it's not true, that they have the truth, and that everything you do is wrong. And so you start to second guess, if I stray from what Sirin said even a little bit, then it's as if like the whole book will be false. And the moment that I realized that that's not right, that's not true, that I should stop second guessing myself and I should just tell the story, was a big kind of moment. I mean, I remember I was talking to a friend, Shireen Sayali, and she's a professor at Santa Barbara. And I started crying, like when I just realized it was like a whole kind of like something, a veil that was taken over, lifted, that I could just write.
Thank you so much for you both. And Sami, how hard was it for you to gain access to the people that you wanted to talk with? I mean, Serene was, well, obviously a big help probably to meet many people, but as an outsider for you, somehow, how hard was it to gain to gain access to the people?
Yeah, I mean, I think Serene can probably speak to some of that too, as I think she opened all the doors in that sense for me. Even in one of my trips, I think she wasn't there, my first trip, and she made phone calls and made sure that, you know, people were taking care of me. That made it really easy. I did hire at one point a research assistant to help do some other interviews. For the most part, yeah, it was. And I think, I don't know, Serene, if you want to sort of say anything about that.
Yeah, usually, like my father used to say, you talk to anybody and everywhere and anywhere. I'm very comfortable in approaching people, and I make it very easy to really make phone calls, and I stay connected with people. Even if I live for 20, 30 years, I always stay connected with people I met, even for once or twice, because I always say that's what built community, friends and family and people who you met in your path. So when Sami went, or when he even came to Jordan, when he came a few times to Palestine, I was able to keep making those phone calls and make sure that people are comfortable talking to him. Even a couple of times I went and Sami wasn't there, I went and met so many people, and I record them and I will send it to Sami. I will ask so many questions, which is maybe a lot of the recording we did not include in the story, but I felt Sami should read it, look at it, hear it. It will give him idea about the community in general. And I'm too much paying attention to details, and Sami maybe noticed that. He will be describing something and I will go, no, this is how it happened exactly. This is 1, 2, 3. And this is how the details, even the details of what we're wearing, what we're eating, and how the furniture is laid out in the house. So I cared a lot about those stuff. I feel like when the reader read it, he could close his eyes and see the surrounding of the area.
And Serene, I'm not sure if these questions work, but with all the experience that you had in Palestine and after, how did the political events that happened had an impact on your life story as a whole? Can you say something about this a little bit?
I mean, If we did not have the occupation, I would not be leaving after high school to study in Jordan. It was the first Intifada, and my mom and my dad were worried about us going to college in the West Bank, either in Bir Zeit or Najah, because it was very difficult for a girl to commute from those cities back to the village. You need to remember, I'm talking about a village in the 70s and the 80s. When I left, even we did not have a phone. We did not have an electricity. We did not have water. Water, we were collected it from the well in the wintertime, from the rooftop to the well. Electricity, every few family has a generator. So for my mom and dad, to be me commuting to another city in the West Bank, in Palestine, and traveling back to the village in daily basis was very difficult for them. It's not safe to be in the road. So we ended up, the occupation ended up separating me from my family to Jordan. And living in Jordan and be far from my family, some of my siblings grew up not knowing me, except this visitor who come once or twice, maybe a year, because of the hardship and the checkpoint and the border between Amman and Kfar Rai. And just being in the checkpoint from Jordan to the Israeli checkpoint to Jericho to the Palestinian checkpoint, you're talking about up to 18 hours. Making a decision to get married and move to the U.S. because of the political situation in the West Bank and in Palestine. And then moving to the U.S., it was very hard for me to visit my family the first 4 years. Financially, I could not afford the ticket and the trip to Amman and then crossing the border. And it's not just crossing the border, it's the hours where the border open and the thousands of people are waiting in the summer because that's the only time I'm free to cross. Then later on, when my brother being targeted and arrested, I became a threat even visiting because I will be targeted by the Israeli. So all of this impacted my life and decision I had in my life. And then now, even after the book come out and after October 7, I'm afraid even to go back and visit. What could happen to me? And then leaving my family behind, and feeling I'm the lucky one because I'm living in the United States, I'm closing my door, I'm feeling safe. Well, they cannot have that feeling. Anytime the Israeli occupation can bang in that door and break it and bomb it and walk in and search them and interrogate them for hours and arresting them. I mean, many times my mom was arrested for a few hours, and my sister, my brother. I mean, I have three family members who spent months and years in prison. Literally, this has impacted who I am until now. Again, seeing what's going on in Gaza, reminding people, this is not something just happened because of October 7. This is something 1948 impacted my father and my grandparents. This is something happened in 1967, impacted my mom and her family and me. I was 1 year old. And all the decision we took on our life was impacted with that because of the occupation. So if we did not have the occupation, I could see me and my children growing up in a peaceful city and countries called Palestine. And that's very hard. So it's really changed my life, changed my path and my education and my children's path and education too.
Thank you so much, Serene. And you mentioned October 7, of course, and Sami, maybe if you want to add, how do you think the book, A Story from Palestine, has any context or any connection to what's happening right now in Palestine? And yes.
Yeah. You know, we started writing this book in a different time, and then it gets released in this one. And the story is about resistance, about a resistance fighter, amongst other things, right? It's also a story of the village. It's a story of dispossession and the pain, but it's about this fighter who's with Islamic Jihad, which is participating today in Gaza and the resistance also, right? So there is that continuity. There's also what's going on in Jenin, which is also where Iyad was participating. And so I think for me, then and now, I wanted to be able to tell the story of resistance, no matter what kind of resistance. And we can sit and debate whether we agree or disagree on the type of resistance, but a story of resistance nevertheless, right? And to be able to tell the life, the resistance without really any apology for it. And I think when we see what October 7 was a moment of resistance, and we can again debate on the methods and whatnot. But at the end of the day, you have people who are facing occupation, who are facing a system of apartheid, who are facing a system of settler colonialism. And any people, me, you, Syrian, anyone, is going to resist that. And it's not always pretty. It's not always, the way you might like it, or I might like it, or Syrian might like it. But it is what it is, in a sense. And I think that I think there's a continuity there, because there's always, from the other side, of course, the necessity to demonize the resistance. And when they demonize the resistance, they demonize any kind of resistance. If you speak out and you say from the river to the sea, the speech is demonized. If you take up arms, the weapons and the fighter are demonized. If you do boycotts, that's demonized, and that's considered violent. If you put up a poster, you shout someone down, it's demonized. So there is really, there is really anything you can do that's not demonized. So I think that that continuity is important to be able to understand, and to see some of the roots of 1967, 1948, when Syrian was born, her parents were born, her brother's resistance, etc. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sami. Do you want to add something, Syrian, or?
Yeah, it's just like Sami said, we have to always to explain and justify our act. And as a Palestinian, there is a history, and everybody's seen it, but they ignore it. Our roots is there, and we were born generation and generation. When I said my grandfather or my great-grandfather was born in Nazareth, and then my father was born there, then I have the right to that land, and I have the right to defend that land, and I have the right to defend my home. And when I see people are taking it by force, when I see a member of my family being tortured and killed and harassed, when I see being stabbed in border and checkpoint and ask why you're here, many times by Israeli soldiers, when I see the settlers are moving and taking and uprooting olive trees, which is that's been planted and growing in Palestine. Like, my mom has trees she keep telling us going over since the Roman Empire. We're calling them Roman trees. And they've been uprooted for settlers to move on freely and take arms and take lands by force from the Palestinian. It's people has to understand that the Palestinian has to carry arms to basically fight for their rights. And sadly, a lot of media are mispresenting Palestinian. Even media now in the U.S. with university protest, it's the most peaceful protest any country could see and face. But then they presenting us as the violence, as the terrorists, as this and that in the American media. So it's really heartbreaking to see what's going on. Princeton University student, for example, has been today their 11th day of encampment protesting for divest from Israeli university and weapon making company investment. And the students are in hunger strike. And what I seen last night was a video of two students who attacked the hunger strike, ripped their sign and get away with it, while the university security or police were surrounding, did not do anything. But if it was a Palestinian who did that, then we were a terrorist, we were violence, and look at us. But when another people doing it, it's fine. So when Palestinian people carry arm or try to defend their land, defend their history, their ancestor land, we already basically called terrorists, and we are always called to be the violent people. And it's very sad to see that the world are not, the rest of the world and the UN are not doing anything, with over 40,000 already killed. One third of the 40,000, even more, are children who are under 18 years old. And we are standing silent, waiting for what? More genocide and more genocide being happening toward the Palestinian. Every time Palestinians are speaking, we are the violence. And it's just seeing that as a Palestinian who living in the U.S., having three children who are born and raised here, how it's a heartbreak for me.
Thank you so much, Sirin and Sami, both of you. And coming maybe to the last question of the conversation, like, how would you describe the book, of the genre of the book? Is it, I mean, it's part academic, but it's part a life story as well. So what did you had in mind while writing the book?
I think for me, I see this book as a creative nonfiction. As I said earlier in the conversation, we wanted this to be a story that people would pick up and read, and it, not just scholars, in academia, or even just students who are asked to read it for a class, but that you could pick it up while you're on a train and read it. You can pick it up before going to sleep. You know, a story that not creative nonfiction. It has. It is, I would say, experimental in that it has forms of memoir in it. It has forms of oral history in it, the two voices. So I was trying to experiment, but I was insistent. And when I was working with the publisher was also, insisted in making sure that there was a narrative flow, that characters were well developed, and so on. The sort of things that you would think about if you were writing a novel. So that's sort of what I had in mind. And, we're lucky that someone reviewed the book and said that it's also recommended for young adults, and so that was a really great compliment that we could do something that young adults might be able to pick up.
Thank you so much, Sami, and yes, Sirin?
Yes.
And did you do you still want to continue working together, both of you, or what are you thinking of doing next?
I mean, listen, I have three children. When I met Sami, I was already a mother of three children. But even we are close in age, I feel like he's my fourth child. So I'm not going to be separated anytime soon from him. And hopefully we'll keep working and talking about this book. And I feel like I would love this book to be read mostly with the Western American reader, because I feel those are the generation is going to make a difference. Without the European and the American, and basically standing up with Palestine, the Palestinian would not achieve their freedom and their rights, full right to be living in their land. So you could see the changes come from those country. And from those children. So hopefully more university will pick the book, more schools will pick a book. Like when Sami said, it was recommended for a young reader. Hopefully people can relate to the story of the children of Palestine and the family lifestyle and advocate for our cause. And this is where we're starting. Yeah. And hopefully we can keep doing program like yours and being interviewed and work with more stuff, and more young generations coming up can visit Palestine and learn about the Palestinian.
Thank you so much, Sirin. Do you want to add something, Sami?
I would just say that I think now we're hoping that there'll be an Arabic translation, and that'll be something I think that will keep maybe Sirin busier than me. But also I keep telling her that maybe she should record, do sort of more, TikTok, things like that, where she's, because, as you can get a small taste in this interview, but maybe if people attend any of our talks, she's a very wonderful, amazing storyteller, just is able to capture a crowd in that way. So hopefully she'll she'll take my advice.
Yes, I want it. It's just like I've been so busy with all this university in Kanban, and I want to support all the community too. And then we were in Qatar and we were in Kuwait. I just came back like, 4 days ago? And believe me, from the airport to Princeton University, I didn't even come home. I feel I have a big responsibility in my shoulders, and I feel the voice of the Palestinian people who cannot speak. And I feel if I'm missing the support of anybody who's standing with the Palestinian, I feel guilt. So I would love to do that and keep speaking and encouraging a lot of Palestinians all around Palestine to keep speaking and boasting their voice in social media. And hopefully one day audience in Germany and translated to German and to Spanish and to French and to Russian and to a lot of languages around the world. So we'll have more audience and more people are reading the story.
Thank you so much for you both for being on the podcast today with me. And thank you for the great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for you and for all your audience. And I have a wish from your audience to share this conversation with a lot of people, to encourage more people to read about the Palestinians and meet them and learn about their cultures and food and tradition and customs. So hopefully more of your audience will be reaching out to learn more about the Palestinian people.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.